The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie, in for David Martin Davies. It's just about time to go back to school, which is really exciting for most kids, but for some, it's really stressful. School is harder for them than it is for their friends, and they don't know why. They may have learning differences or disabilities, which are neurological conditions that interfere with a person's ability to store, process, or produce information. In the 2017-2018 school year, 7 million public school students got special education services. 34% of those students were identified as having a specific learning disability. So what are the signs and symptoms that your child, or one you love, may be processing information differently? How do you find out for sure? Then what? Today on The Source, we're joined by Louise O'Donnell, a psychologist with training in child neuropsychology at UT Health San Antonio. Beth McGaw, she's the board president of Learning Disabilities Association of America. And Kristen O'Donnell, no relation to Louise, she's a psychologist who teaches in a school psychology, master's program and counseling psychology doctoral program at Our Lady of the Lake University. If you'd like to talk about your experiences with having a learning disability yourself or going down this path with your child, give us a call, 210-614-8980, or email us at thesource@tpr.org. We'd love for you to join the conversation. Welcome, everybody. I'd like to start off on the phone with Beth McGaw. She's the board president of Learning Disabilities Association of America. And can you tell me exactly what is a specific learning disability?
Well, you mentioned that a learning disability is a neurological condition that interferes with the individual's ability to store, process, or produce information. But a specific learning disability can include one of seven types of learning disabilities. That would be auditory processing disorders, dyscalculia, dysgraphia, dyslexia, language processing disorder, visual motor processing disorder, and nonverbal learning disabilities. Those are the specific learning disabilities.
Okay, so that's a lot. So school is supposed to be challenging, right? You're learning stuff that you don't know. And so how do you tell, and I'll go to Dr. Louise O'Donnell, how do you know when your kid is dealing with normal challenges of learning? What are the signs and symptoms that it might be more than that?
Well, I would start first with looking at reading difficulties. Dyslexia or reading problems are some of the most common areas of specific learning disability. And if the child at about second grade, I would say, is still maybe not understanding how to do phonological decoding, that is realizing that this letter makes this sound, or if they're cannot put together the words, they're having trouble recognizing common sight words, that's really the basic fundamentals of readings. You need to have that first. Now, the child may also have that, but they are doing it so slowly. So they may also be struggling with fluency. In other words, it's not an automatic process for them because they haven't yet mastered that skill. And last of all, you know, they may have those first two, but they then may also have problems with comprehension. So if you think about it in terms of a triangle, the phonological decoding skills are the first things that you need to look at when you're learning the alphabet and learning what sounds are matched with what letters. And then how quickly can you make that automatic to really understanding what you read. And I would also say that the big push certainly is for kids to learn to read in first and second grade and third grade. But by third grade, you need to be mastering that, because in third grade, the end of third grade, first of fourth grade, I would say, you switch from learning to read to reading to learn. And the child who is still struggling to learn to read cannot obviously keep up with the content in the classroom.
Kristen, how many kids get past second, third grade into fourth, fifth, and sixth without ever being caught up in the net of kids that may need and benefit from some help?
How many kids?
Yeah, I mean, this is common.
Probably quite a few. Teachers tend to look for students who are struggling significantly with gaining those skills that, mm-hmm. that Louise was talking about, gaining and reading comprehension and reading fluency. But then there's also these difficulties that they might have in math and in writing because of the fact that we need reading in order to do every other subject area in school. So the students who are struggling quite significantly are going to be those who get caught first. So that if you have, the more difficulties you have with learning and the more it is delayed, then you're going to be sent for certain types of interventions first. But those who struggle just in one area might not get caught right away. So there might be students who get passed up to the next grade level without actually having the fundamentals that they need.
Right.
I agree. And I also think sometimes that kids that have a neurodevelopmental disorder of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, oftentimes their behavior is very hyper and impulsive and disruptive, and it's being done for a reason. I mean, they really have the neurological disorder, but they also may be trying to hide the fact that they have underlying academic difficulties. And if the focus of the intervention is totally on the behavior, the reading or the math or the writing kind of slips by.
Right.
It just slips by.
Sometimes kids might get caught up with this. They might be a bad kid, or they may not be trying very hard when it's really this underlying situation. Is it up to the parent, Kristen, to advocate in that case?
It's really a system that's supposed to work together, so that parents, if they see their child struggling at home with homework, they can say, I wonder why they're struggling. Let me give them some help. And sometimes it's just that they need it to be taught in a different way. But teachers in the classroom need to see, if I taught it a different way, are they still not getting it? And that's when the intervention support should come in to teach them at a slower rate, but also to teach them in a way that they best understand.
All right. So when you sense as a parent or as a teacher something like this may be going on, what's the next step? And let's go to Louise for that.
I would first of all start with the classroom teacher, because that teacher knows the child. And I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kirsten, teachers do benchmarking. And so by that I mean they're going to figure out where each child in the class is functioning in reading, math, writing at the beginning of the school year. And they're going to say, okay, I have this group that's in the lower third, and I need to focus on what's happening with them. So talk to that teacher and get her sense or his sense of what's happening. The parent can also look at the child's homework. Look at the errors.
Okay. All right. We'll talk more about that. We'll talk about the next steps as you go to maybe get a 504 or something like that, any sort of accommodations and help and resources that are out there for kids that may be struggling in this way. That's coming up next. We also want to hear from you. What has your path been like for your children or yourself along the lines of learning disabilities? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. Or you can email us at thesource@tpr.org. The Source continues right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies. We are talking about learning disabilities, detecting them, diagnosing them, getting kids the resources they need to succeed. Because kids with learning disabilities are not less intelligent than other kids, are they, Beth McGaw?
They are very intelligent. I wanted to add from the last conversation that as far as the number of students, it's known that 1 in 5 students in the classroom will have a learning disability of some kind, and that 80% of the kids in special education are known to have learning disabilities, and 80% of those have reading disorders.
That's an awful lot. Those are big numbers.
Right. So, I mean, we really need to think about that when we're talking about, you know, disabilities in general, and the issue that LDA faces, and what we try to advocate for our community is that this is a big number, and we need to be paying attention to this, because there are many kids that are not being identified, and if they much of it is due to the system in our schools of waiting for them to jump through several hoops before they go for a cognitive assessment.
Let's talk about this assessment, Kristen O'Donnell at Our Lady of the Lake. You do those, you have experience with those. What can you tell me about those?
Well, and the process is usually defined by the school district that the child attends. And so typically, the child will go through a process of what they call a multi-tiered system of support. And so first, the teachers will identify through the benchmarks that Louise was talking about earlier that students are not quite on track with the rest of the students in their class. And then those students then will be referred to a team who will develop interventions for that student to determine what that particular student needs in order to be successful. And then that intervention has to have time to work. And so as the intervention works or does not work, someone is monitoring that process. And then it's determined along this multi-tiered system, where tier one is just what everybody receives, and we're looking to see what everybody's getting. And then tier two is more individualized support for students who are struggling. And tier three moves into either additional individual support or referral to for assessment, possibly to look at a 504 programming or to look at a special education programming. And that's when assessment will come into play, typically by a licensed specialist in school psychology or an educational diagnostician in the school system.
Of course, that's in an ideal world, as we both know, or all four of us now on the show know. I'm sure that some folks who are listening have different stories about how this process may work, and you can call us at 210-614-8980. That's 210-614-8980. Louise O'Donnell, what sort of roadblocks in the process do parents often run into?
Well, certainly when they come to me for assessment, because I do assessment through the university as well, they are sometimes frustrated that they've been told that there are lengthy wait times, or some of them come to me because they're seeking a second opinion because they've had the testing and they're not comfortable with what the results have showed. And the school district then reaches out to me to do that testing. So I think it is, number one, that the children are not getting the assessment. And then at times it is that the special education accommodations that they are receiving don't really, they feel like they're not working. And the child needs something extra, and they're not sure where to go. They may be trying to do tutoring on their own or outside tutoring, but they feel like the special education pullout services are not being effective. But other parents' experiences have been that they are working. So I don't want to say, you know, that it's been my experience that these interventions don't work.
I tossed out a term earlier, and I'm going to go to the phone, that it is easy for me to just toss out because I know what it means. My daughter has one. It's Juanita joins us on the phone, and you'd like to know there are various levels of assistance kids can get, and Juanita knows. Well, tell us what your question is, Juanita.
My question was 504. My grandson was diagnosed in fourth grade after many urgings on my part. My daughter finally talked to the teacher and he got assessed and has an IEP. But I keep hearing 504 and I'm trying to understand. I don't even know if that's what he has.
So should Beth, would you like to take this one? Beth McGaw is the president, board president of the Learning Disabilities Association of America. Beth?
Sure. Well, when you get diagnosed, when you go through the process, as we've talked about, and as with a learning disability, then you they have two choices to send you for into the special education program where you get an individual education plan, or you get a 504. And the 504 mainly is for the accommodations that are needed to help with the learning disability and the strategies that are needed to help them.
Okay, we're having a little bit of trouble with the phone line there, but we will definitely get back to you. Kristen, would you like to elaborate a bit on the differences between a 504 and an IEP?
Yes, so there's a leveling system of support under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And so under IDEA, we provide special education support to students who have an identified disability and an academic need. And then typically the individual education plan that's put into place under special education is specifically for that student and identify skills that they have and skills that they need to work on. So the IEP then will be based on all of the skills that the student needs in order to be successful in their grade level classroom. Under 504, it's different. It's more of an ADA accommodation. Under 504, students can receive accommodations like being given extra time to turn in homework, or being provided notes, written notes from their peers or from their teachers in order to help follow along in the classroom better. So accommodations, but not modifications to the curriculum. Under special education, they would be afforded modifications to the curriculum, which is what an individual education plan is.
Beth, I'm going to go back to you again because I've heard a lot of parents say that they don't know what an individual school or school district is required to provide under a 504 plan or an IEP. What are the legal requirements?
Well, it really depends on what the diagnosis is. And I didn't hear part of the conversation, but what I did hear, I think it was Kristen that spoke.
Yes.
What she said was exactly right. Once you get into, if you have an IEP, then you're given some modifications. You might be pulled out of the classroom. You might even have speech and language or some other types of therapy. When you have a 504, it's more the accommodations, extended time, sitting in front of the class, maybe some, if you get into high school, it might be some being able to use a calculator or some extra extended breaks on testing.
Through experience and through the stories of other parents that I've spoken with, it's sometimes difficult to get a school district to stick to a 504. How do you keep them honest, Beth?
Well, you be their number one advocate. You make sure that that you're there for your child, and you're putting everything in writing, and you're requesting meetings if necessary. But we also have to teach our children to be those advocates for themselves, so they know what is needed to help them be successful.
Okay, and that's hard stuff, right? I mean, the kids already challenged in various different ways, and it's a hard process. So when do you think, when should a parent go, and I'll go to you, Louise, say, this 504 isn't quite enough. We need to perhaps go the next step to an IEP. Where do you get the red flag for that?
I'm not sure which. So the parent is dissatisfied.
We've tried the 504, and it's not. Things aren't improving.
Then I would go back to the interdisciplinary team and say, and call a meeting and sit down and say, these accommodations don't seem to be working. I think we need to look at movement from 504 into an IEP, an education, individual education plan. The other difference with that that I think I'd like to make is there are identifiable goals and objectives, and there is an annual review, annual yearly progress that happens in special education that it has been my experience that may or may not happen with 504. And the goals and objectives must be written appropriately, and the child must demonstrate progress. So the old days of just being in special ed and nothing happening, mm-hmm. those days are gone. And so there are clear objectives that the child has to meet, and the teachers do too, the instructors. And if it's not working, then you figure out why. So I think it's calling the team together and sitting down and saying, okay, this isn't working, let's move forward with an assessment of current academic functioning and intellectual functioning. And certainly something that we haven't been talking about, but the emotional functioning of the child as well. Because if you have a child who has been struggling, their self-esteem starts taking a hit. And research has shown that kids that have learning this statistics bothers me, something fierce, that they oftentimes see their success as a matter of luck.
Right.
Whereas kids who do not have a learning difference, they see it as the result of hard work.
Well, Bonner, speaking of hard work, is on the phone, and you aren't a fan of 504s. Real quick, because we're about to go to a break. No, we don't have Bonner right now. I'm sorry about that. But a caller on the line at 210-614-8980 thinks 504s makes kids lazy. We're about to go to a break. But Kristen, thoughts on that?
Well, certainly providing accommodations for students is supposed to be a way to make them more successful in the classroom. If a student is taking advantage of those accommodations, that's something different.
And all kids are different, right?
Right.
It's very individual.
Definitely. And so I would think that that would just be a matter of talking with the child themselves to figure out if they're using this 504 plan as an excuse to not complete work or to not mm-hmm. turn in, assignments, because that certainly is not what 504 or special education is supposed to be about.
Okay. Well, that's good to know, because I think that you run into in districts with people at schools and in life that sort of think that kind of thing mm-hmm. Is just, kids are soft, right? And that's mm-hmm. not the case at all. These kids need these accommodations to succeed. And we're going to talk about, straight ahead after the break, evaluations. We're in a multilingual, multi-ethnic community, particularly in San Antonio and Bexar County. And sometimes kids can get lost, I think, in the shuffle. Is that something you've seen, Kristen?
Yes, and sometimes kids can also be over-identified because they have cultural and linguistic differences.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's really something very important to keep in mind.
Yeah, so are the evaluations different?
Yes, the way that individuals who have a primary language other than English, those evaluations should look much different from the evaluations of someone who has spoken English their entire life.
All right, so we will talk about that coming up here on The Source. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies today, and you can join our conversation on learning disabilities at 210-614-8980. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org, or you tweet us at @tprsource. And then more on learning disabilities, and specifically on ethnic differences and cultural differences in evaluations, coming up on The Source on 89.1 FM.
Immigration.
I think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
Health.
The Promotora, they have all the resources that can get them the help that they need.
Art.
There's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We cover all these topics and more on Fronteras as we examine issues along the border and beyond. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras where you find your favorite podcasts.
And we're back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie, in for David Martin Davies. We're talking about the need for detecting, diagnosing learning disabilities, and getting kids who face these challenges help and help early. It'll improve their lives for their whole lives, improves their abilities to succeed up to their potential. And before we get back to talking about cultural differences, I'd like to go to the phone where Alex has been standing by, and her son has, and I'm going to mess this up, dyscalculia. And she's got some questions about getting a diagnosis. So let's start with Louise. Alex, what's your question?
So my grade was diagnosed with dysgraphia. He's been having reading problems since he was in second grade, and they kept putting him in all these reading intervention groups and having him stay after school for extra tutoring and things like that. And even though we went to the school counselor and asked for help, they kept saying no. The teachers kept, you know, saying he's got ADD, ADHD. You need to take him to your doctor, and you have him, you know, diagnosed and get him on medication. And that was their way of trying to deal with his reading issues. And so I guess my question is, here we are now, seventh graders coming this year, and we finally got our diagnosis, and we had a school counselor do a test on him, and they said that he had dysgraphia, which is a reading problem similar to dyslexia. And however, they still haven't made any accommodations for him. Last year, we moved him to a charter school, and it wasn't until it was time to do our STAR testing that they said, oh, well, we want to be able to read him some of the questions and want to give him some extra time and things like that for those tests, because they were the standardized tests. However, they didn't do any of those things during the school year. So I guess I just wanted to kind of bring that up and, you know,
sure.
See
Beth.
What else can be done.
Beth McGaw, I'm going to reach out to you on this one. With what you just heard, what should she do next? What should Alex do?
Well, again, I mean, the first person you would reach out to would be the teacher, and I've obviously done that. Then you need to reach out to that team or the principal to let them know about what you've observed. And I would put it in writing. And so that everybody involved knows the situation, and I would just keep fighting. Unfortunately, that's the way the system works. And if that doesn't work, then you may need to hire a special education advocate to get, what your son needs.
But when I hear things like that, I start to think, wow, so that means that only middle class and higher kids can access help, because how many parents can really hire an advocate?
That is a problem, and there is that disproportionality. There are kids that are in more affluent school districts that are probably more identified than ones that are in lower income districts. And what we're talking about as far as diagnosis is and the strategies that are used in getting IEPs and 504s. It doesn't just it's not just a state-to-state issue, it's a district-to-district, school-to-school issue.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really have we need to be a little bit better, or a lot better, at being more consistent on what we give our kids.
Yeah, I'll take off my reporter hat and my host hat for a second and put on my mom hat and say, why does it have to be so hard?
Right.
You know, why does it have to be so hard? My daughter was in two school districts last year because it is so hard. I mean, That's my question for you, Beth. Why does it have to be so hard?
Well, it doesn't have to be so hard. It shouldn't be, and that's what LDA, the Learning Disabilities Association, is here. We help fight for the rights of those who have learning disabilities. We have a policy director in Washington, and we have state affiliates all over the country, including here in Texas. And so, you know, we're watching the laws and trying to create that dialogue so that kids, get the help they need. I don't know if you remember, but back probably about 4 years ago, we had another journalist, Brian Rosenthal, who is at the Houston Chronicle, had really, brought to light the what was happening here in Texas, where there was a limit on the number of a percentage limit, 8.6%, I believe, where schools were only allowed to identify that many kids for special education, which we know you can't put a limit on those. Learning disabilities are real. They're lifelong. They can be genetic. And they're not because a child is lazy. It's something that should be identified early, and kids will have the most success. I also like to point out that we need to train our general ed teachers more about learning disabilities, because more and more of our kids are in inclusion classrooms, and general ed teachers do not get the training during their teacher preparation programs about learning disabilities and how to identify them and how to and the strategies that they need to use in the classroom.
That's crazy to me that general education teachers don't have that kind of training right now.
Yeah, it is crazy. Although, good news, I went to the Summer Dyslexia Institute. I'll give them a shout out. It's at Region 10. And there were close to 900 teachers that were signed up for that. And I was very happy to see that there were teachers and professionals going to help get themselves the training that they need to identify and, you know, help these kids.
I'm going to look at an email that we just got. James is an elementary school teacher. He had a kid who applied to be tested for learning disabilities around the beginning of the school year. The kid didn't get tested until a few weeks before the end of the year, then found out he won't even qualify because of attendance issues. James says he understands limited resources, but asks, and I'm going to toss it at both of you, you know, how can we make this process faster? And they're looking at each other questioningly.
Certainly my experience has been, and it's what we've said, I can't stress that enough. It has to come from the parents. The squeaky wheel gets the attention. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it depends on the teachers. There are some wonderful, very highly motivated teachers that identify these kids and kind of quietly push and encourage the parents. They can't say it. I am told they cannot say it outright, but they point the parents to websites where they can learn the steps that they need to take. And, you know, again, it starts at the parent and the teacher level. And then also I think parents need to realize that if you're not getting satisfaction at the school level, then you move up to the region level or to, you know, to their district level. A lot of specialists in school psychology, they're not located in the schools themselves, so you can't run down the hall and talk to the school psychologist. They travel.
Mm-hmm. So, Beth, real quick, part of James's email brought a question to my mind. What does attendance have to do with him not qualifying for help? Do you know?
It shouldn't.
Oh, okay. Kristen's raising her hand, so I'm going to just toss it over to her real quick.
Go ahead.
Part of qualifying with a specific learning disability is having access to education. So if there is a large number of absences within a school year, then it's difficult to determine if the child does not understand the concept because they weren't there, or if they don't understand the concept because they don't have the cognitive, their cognitive processing is different, which would not allow them to get the skill right away. And so there is an attendance piece to determining if somebody has a specific learning disability, because you have to be present for instruction in order to say whether or not you did not understand.
And that's the hard thing, though, is that kids who are struggling tend not to want to go to school.
Yes, there's this motivation piece that is difficult, too, because the harder something is for someone, then the more difficult that is to put so much effort into it. But we're asking folks who have specific learning disabilities to try even harder than those who do not, and that is tough.
So let's go back to the topic that I said we were talking about before. Is that Beth? Go ahead.
Yes, I agree with Kristen. That's true. And when you get an evaluation, I mean, it's part of it isn't just testing. It's that detailed developmental history. So if that student had a cognitive assessment done with a detailed and the detailed developmental history and teacher and parent and student input with interview and questionnaires. It's a lot of information put into one report, and then it will tell what kind of accommodations are needed and what are the strategies needed in the classroom. So if that was done, then attendance shouldn't be an issue unless that's part of the report.
Mm-hmm. And it is part of, legally, that's part of something that has to be included in a school-based report. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And there's a certain amount of attendance that's required,
right,
just to pass school, period, right? I mean, that...
And it's not just missing a couple days. That really wouldn't be the case, but it would be a large number of days within a semester or within a school year.
And go ahead, Louise.
And this is somewhat similar. I work with families whose kids have chronic illness, and they struggle sometimes with getting the schools to understand that their children are sick for long periods of time, and hence they cannot be physically present in the school. And I've been working with a family.
All right, yeah, and there are homebound programs. We can talk about that at some point before the show's over. But I do want to get back to you, Kristen, after the break and talk about bilingual kids or English as second language kids and how they can access resources that they need to get the help they need to succeed. You are listening to The Source on 89.1 FM, Texas Public Radio. You can give us a call and join the conversation at 210-614-8980. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies, and there are a couple of callers I want to get to, but I really want to drill down on what we brought up earlier about the differences for kids who are bilingual or perhaps speak English as a second language. What are the differences for kids in those groups? How do they access help?
Well, there's a difference in the evaluation procedure for students who have cultural and linguistic differences. And so primarily, what we would begin with is assessing for language and determining which language is the child's primary language. So in Texas, we typically think English and Spanish, but it can be many, many languages,
sure,
especially outside of San Antonio. There's students who speak lots of different kinds of languages. And so what they want to evaluate first is to determine if there is a language difference that then is getting in the way of attaining academic success.
Sure.
And if it's a language difference, then that's when ESL programs or bilingual programs can help to introduce concepts in the child's native language, first language. And then the English gets taught the same way that math skills and reading skills and other skills get taught. But if it's determined that they need to be evaluated for a specific learning disability, then that the language of assessment needs to be in that primary language also.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is the process longer? Is it harder to determine that a kid may even need to go through this process?
So the process may have more steps because there's the language piece to it, and we have to make sure that it is not that they're having trouble with their English language and that that's causing the academic skills. So that part might make it a little bit longer, but actually the testing that goes into for specific learning disabilities particularly, that testing has lots of facets to it. So a bilingual licensed specialist in school psychology or a bilingual educational diagnostician should be the one who's administering the tests in that child's primary or native language.
All right, Louise O'Donnell, a psychologist with training in child neuropsychology at UT Health San Antonio, just to remind folks who we're listening to. So it feels to me like that particular population is ripe for kids falling through the cracks. How do we sort of make sure that doesn't happen? Either one of you is fine.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I feel like it's the same process-wise, it should be the same for students regardless of what their language skills are.
Sure.
And so just making sure that we're monitoring what our child knows and what our child doesn't know. And then also, I would say as a society, as schools are interacting with students and parents who might speak a different language, making sure that we discuss the skill development and the child's difficulties with skill development, that we talk about that in the same way with Spanish-speaking parents that we do with English-speaking parents.
Sure, sure.
So not letting language be a barrier.
So we've talked a lot about advocacy, I do want to go to a caller. We've talked a ton about how important advocacy is, right? How the parents really have to be the warriors, and I know this from experience, and build the team and fight the fight. And it's harder for parents for whom English is a second language, or perhaps they don't even speak English. But it's also really hard for working parents. And Delia joins us on the phone. Hi, Delia. Oh, we lost Delia. So, but it's hard, right? When you work full time, and then you've got to somehow find a way to advocate for your kid in whatever time remains in life. So go ahead.
I had a thought. You know, it can be intimidating to be a parent who comes to an ARD meeting. Because here are all these professionals, and I have this report that I maybe understand, not a lot, and I am not sure how I need to advocate for my child.
And those, you know, they're so intimidating in those
rooms.
Yes, you know?
And especially if you are in disagreement with what the experts are saying. So imagine somebody whose first language is not English. So coming and talking to a group of professionals is incredibly daunting. And I think the schools, it is the responsibility of the ARD teams headed by the LSSPs to reach out to these families and to really make it a positive interaction. And I remember what I was taught in school, that you focus on not only where the child is having difficulties, but on what the child is doing well. And
right.
You go around and you say, this teacher says, well, he's really awesome with this. And everybody says, well, how did you get that? And it becomes a collaborative effort rather than something that is very negative and painful and intimidating. And I think schools vary in their abilities to do that.
Yeah.
I'd like to add to
okay.
that if I can. Just
go ahead.
One best practice that many school psychology programs will teach, and I know we teach at Our Lady of the Lake, is that you review the evaluation report with the parent in a private meeting so that you take as much time as the parent needs to understand that report, that you have those conversations with them. They ask you all the questions that they need to ask. And then maybe a day later, you go into an ARD meeting where the parent has some time to really think about what that evaluation says. And so that is a best practice concept that parents can advocate for too. If they want that to happen before the ARD meeting, they can request that meeting.
Parents can get extra time too.
Yes.
Well, that's exciting. I never thought of that going through the process. Let's just sit down and go over it. So we've talked a little bit about how kids with learning disabilities are sometimes perceived as lazy, sometimes perceived as not trying so hard, sometimes perceived as not as smart. Katie has called in. Katie, gifted and talented. Yes?
Hi, yes.
Tell me
yes,
more.
My child has dyslexia and is a GT student, and she qualified under the 504 plan. And when we met with our advocate last year, well, 2 years ago, because we were having difficulty with the elementary school agreeing to do any accommodations because she had passed the STAR test because she is so bright. And fills in the blanks with her mind, but can't read individual words or remember how to spell them. But if it's in context, she just figures out what it should mean. But now that we're in middle school, we're getting a lot more help. But then I was told that now dyslexia can fall under special ed, and so we're going to go ahead and do special ed testing because I did a parent request. Even though they always tell us, well, your child is too high, I say, well, can I do a parent request anyway for special ed testing? And they say, yes, you can. So I put it in writing, and we're going to do that. Do you have any information about this change of dyslexia from only 504 to 504 and special education? And also, I wanted to say for that caller earlier on who called in and was confused, and I was a teacher in Northside for 15 years, and I have a student with medical and learning disabilities and special needs. It's still, I'm sure, it's so confusing, but this is how I think of it. If your child has any problems, they can qualify under two things, 504 and or special ed. They can have one or they can have both. 504 is for Americans with disabilities. If you have cancer, if you have one leg, if you have asthma, if you have ADHD, and then you have a meeting called a 504 meeting to figure out what would help your child, and then you have a plan on paper called a 504 plan. But if you have other problems that fall under special education, then you request special education testing. And if you qualify, then you have a meeting called an ARD, A-R-D, and then you have a plan on paper called an IEP.
Well, so Katie's obviously an advocate. She's a warrior, and she knows her stuff. And thank you for your call, and thank you for advocating for your child and calling in and advocating for others. But you did have a question back in the back there, and I saw you both nodding your heads. So I'm guessing you both have answers. So Louise, you want to start?
Well, I'm refreshed my memory. What the
she
question?
She was talking what about dyslexia and special ed.
And if you're gifted.
Yes, and there were the changes. Now she's going for special ed now. Go ahead, Kristen.
So the dyslexia has always been a reading disorder.
Yeah.
But in Texas, we had a difference in where the folks who were determined to be dyslexic were serviced, and that was under the 504 program. In other states, dyslexia is part of special education as a reading disorder. And so we're beginning to see that now where we are moving to that, where we can evaluate to determine if it looks like a severe or a specific learning disability in basic reading or reading comprehension or reading fluency, which would be under the special education categories, or if it is a student who does not have certain deficits in their cognitive processing areas, but instead have a very well-developed overall IQ, mm-hmm. without differences, with no discrepancies, but they still struggle with reading, which is how dyslexia manifests itself, that there's a struggle with reading, just like what the caller was talking about.
Right.
But they are still gifted and understand things if it's in context. Just the word isolation is something that's struggled with.
Okay.
So what she will be doing is to really evaluating whether or not her child has cognitive processing difficulties, which also will give her an answer.
I wish we could talk about this for another hour, but we can't. It's time to go. What are your favorite resources, though, real quick? Beth McGaw, do you have a favorite resource for parents starting on this journey to go to?
Well, obviously, the Learning Disability Association of America website.
There you go. There you go.
But I would like to point out that learning disabilities, dyslexia is a learning disability.
Right.
And that it should qualify for an IEP.
Okay. Well, I thank you so much. Thank you for joining us. Louise O'Donnell from UT Health San Antonio, Kristen O'Donnell from Our Lady of the Lake University, and Beth McGaw, the president, board president of the Learning Disabilities Association of America. You have been listening to The Source. Right here, I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Ross Piedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director.